One of the most engaging themes over the last week at Holden and on into this week has been the theme of the Christian faith and how we deal with economics. And tonight we will have for the forum a discussion on that controversy. Paul Hain, who has been on the faculty here at Holden, is a lecturer in economics at the University of Washington. And Larry Rasmussen, who is a program director at Holden and professor of social ethics at Wesley Seminary and an author, Economic Anxiety and Christian Faith, are going to share a couple insights that they have to set the theme for the forum. And after they have each given opening statements and responses, the idea of the question whether corporate power is a major social problem or not, we will then use the bulk of our time for you to be able to question or comment to Larry and Paul. And so I would ask Paul if you would open with any statements that you have to give for the evening.
I'm going to open with a very short statement. When Larry and I talked about this, how we would go about this, tried to work it out, we agreed that I would finally come up with about three propositions that I thought needed to be defended. And I'm just going to give you the first one, because Larry thought this is the one I thought was most important, and he also thought it was most important, and he responded all over me with it. So the other... this was the statement. The U.S. economic system is far more competitive today than it was 80 years ago. I pick 80 years ago because that was the turn of the century. It's been getting steadily more competitive. Corporate power is not a major social problem. I believe that. I will defend that proposition. But first of all, we've got to hear the other side.
you've already heard this, what is probably the statement of the other side, that namely corporate power is a major social problem. Although I will come back and say that I think there's high competition among large corporations. I will contend that there is that, and that it is at the same time corporate power is a major social problem. I want to be clear that my main reason for contending that corporate power is a major social problem is a theological one. The London Times supplement once said that the doctrine of original sin was the only Christian doctrine that was empirically verifiable. And the teaching on sin is that we tend to organize our lives in groups both small and large in ways that serve our perceived self-interest at the expense of the well-being of others. The implication of that, it seems to me, is that injustice arises from maldistribution of power. And that'll be key to what I want to contend. That injustice arises from maldistribution of power. The implication of that is that we are rightfully suspicious of high concentrations of power, whether they are in politics, whether those are economic concentrations of power, whether they are concentrations of power that show up in social patterns such as male and female, or even whether it's a concentration of power of human over against the non-human. I am always, on the basis of the teaching on sin, suspicious of high concentrations of power. I think I would even want to say that all great concentrations of power are demonic. Now, corporate power is major. Defense companies, energy corporations, agribusiness, a comparatively small number of corporations produce and handle and sell a very large percentage of national and international or play a very large role in international and national markets. So, for example, five agribusinesses in in the states control 85% of the grain shipments abroad. Two of those, Cargill and Continental, have 25% each of the international market. So corporate power is major. That's the first item. Secondly, corporate power has sought, and rather successfully, the aid of high concentrations of political power. The history on oil prior to the formation of OPEC is an intriguing one in the relationship between American government and American corporations. And you may want to check that out. I've just been reading the book by Jürgen and Stobau, the Harvard study on energy future, which details some of that history. That's only one instance of a case where we have had quite successful interlocking of high concentrations of political and economic power. So I do not think it's a matter of getting the government out of the way and letting the free market operate. The real political choice facing us is the entanglement of the nation state as a concentration of political power with large corporations as a concentration of economic power. So we have the Chrysler, Lockheed, oil depletion allowances, lobbying power, private sector groups, etc. Now, something about social problems. I will contend that major social problems flow from high concentrations of power, and corporate power is one example. I have a friend, Anne Huron, who is a professor of medieval studies and in general a historian of family life. It's fun talking with Anne about the changes of family through epochs. And her contention, and that's shared by many, is that industrial society has been heavily destructive of extended family and even of nuclear family, that there has been also a loss of a sense of neighborhood. What Paul said last night was the fault of the nation state, I think is equally a reality of economic dynamics, where you have a loss of or a destruction of mediating structures that is in part traceable to the way in which our economic system works with these large corporations. My brother was, quote, asked 3 times in 5 years to move with his family to 3 different locations in the United States. Well, that kind of mobility, which is a part of the economic system, is hard on family. So you have a very different kind of family situation. Or family farms are not the same as farms owned by large corporations. I would judge an economic system by whether or not it builds or tears down human community. And I do not think that large concentrations of economic power in the corporations, by and large, build up human community. Now, there are lots of benefits and lots of costs, so that's a general assessment. Okay, so that's one of the evils, is very, very hard on neighborhood, on family, on many mediating structures. A second one is that I do not think that the values which have tended to be the values of our kind of economic society, industrial society in general, are ones which we, from a Christian perspective, would want to encourage. Lewis Mumford says that the new economics, by which he meant capitalism, glorified every single one of the 7 deadly sins except sloth. So that you have a kind of institutionalizing of envy, advertising, or of gluttony, or of greed. Those things are promoted by the kind of economic life in which we have. Or there is a tendency to, in the just the overwhelming a place of economics in our life, to give all things market value. I was once, I was reading a piece by Dorothea Zola, and she talks about walking along a beach with a friend, and her friend said, "Look at that beautiful shell. I wonder what it's worth." A tendency to make, I mean, even matters of art, something that we would, that gets value from the market. Well, I'm not blaming huge corporations for all of this. I'm trying to characterize the nature of industrial society. But in that society, the significant actors now are big business and big government. Where in our economic life, and by way of contrast, are the religious virtues of gratitude and restraint and humility and reverence and kind of gentle striving for justice promoted? I want to ask, can we do any better in our economic life to promote such values instead of all of the seven deadly sins except sloth? Incidentally, and Paul and I talked about this just briefly, I think that capitalism depends upon a set of social values. Adam Smith contended that. What worries me is that the very system which depended upon that, such as honesty, has eroded those very values. And that's something which is contended by a lot of folks. I'll take two more minutes. This is from an article by Roger Shin in Christianity in Crisis. But the competitive forces released by the market system often eroded the traditional moral base that the system presupposed. The glorification of competition is not the same as the glorification of generosity. So much of the world has experienced a social degeneration. The evidences are criminal conduct, the scrambling for wealth at the cost of the poor, the loss of common civic purposes in many, many societies. And Hirsch, talking about Emanuel Hirsch, about Fred Hirsch, finds consumption-oriented socialism no better in performance than capitalism. Social systems will work, he proposes, only when there are some internalized altruistic norms of behavior. On the final page of his book, he says, quote, "We may be near the limits of explicit social organization possible without a supporting social morality." In a similar vein, economist Robert Heilbrunner ends his book, Inquiry into the Human Prospect, with a hope, wavering but wistful, for the power of conscience and of religious affirmations. I worry that the values which we cherish are being eroded by our kind of economic life. Or that there are incentives in our economic life and expressed through the life of corporations which are antithetical to deep Christian themes, a sense of stewardship where we have long-haul concerns. I was appalled at reading about the Japanese whaling industry where that I thought to myself, gosh, in the name of self-interest, the Japanese whaling industry is going to be careful about the harvesting of whales because that industry itself has its own survival at stake. But it didn't turn out that way, and the reason why was because the whaling industry was part of a conglomerate The conglomerate decided that there was a good return on the whales, and when they were finished off, it would shift its energies, talents, to another of its areas, so the whales could go, and they would then harvest something else to get a good return. Well, that's not stewardship. And there are other deep Christian themes which I think are not promoted by the kind of incentives in our corporate economic life. Finally, industrial society and the way in which we put it together now with high concentration corporations has a very strong urban bias over the rural sector. Most of the poor people of the world are rural. Most people live rurally. And I think the whole nature of large corporate enterprises is one which favors urban for lots of perfectly rational reasons over the rural. That means it's an economic system which does not handle very well a very large portion of the problem of poverty. So, conclusion. I would favor, for theological as well as empirical reasons, a bias toward more widely shared economic power, toward simplicity, rather than the present state, which is a bias in favor of concentrated power and a high complexity of organization and technology. I would also favor something which seems to me to be better in tune with nature, upon which any and all economic life is finally and totally dependent. All right.
In a scribbling way.
Yes, and I have the advantage because Larry showed me his detailed notes earlier today, and then I've listened to him and scribbled. And so when I'm through, he will want, I know you will, you will want at least a word. I do not want to deny the importance of the problems to which Larry is pointing. The social degeneration that he talks about. I have no significant quarrel with him there. But I think that by focusing on corporations as the cause, he radically misconceives what's happening. And by misconceiving the cause of the problem, he is preventing us from getting anywhere near a solution. The whale problem just nicely illustrates that. The whale problem is caused by the lack of private ownership of whales. Now, I'm not saying that people should own whales, but what I am saying is that you have to expect that to happen as long as the people who take whales don't, it doesn't cost them anything to take a whale. The reason that farmers don't decimate their herds of cows is because they bear the cost of doing so. The reason that the Japanese and the Russian whaling fleets simply ignore the viability, the long-run viability of the whale population is because if the Japanese don't grab them, the Russians will. That's the standard problem of a common resource. And if we talk about corporations and think somehow this is corporate greed, my goodness, little, simple, small, rural, primitive fishermen created this problem years and years ago. They overfished the fishing banks. They didn't need a large corporation to do it. What'd you say?
I agree they didn't need the large corporation to do it.
But I mean, the problem arises, the problem will and does arise. Well, this is just an illustration. It arises with thousands of fishermen. The same problem can arise and has in the past. The large trading corporations that Larry, grain trading corporations that Larry mentioned, nicely illustrate a problem. What I would call the weakness of the usual statistical case against big business corporations. Though there are only five, I submit that none of them has any significant market power. I'll quarrel about this, but I think the evidence is pretty good that they cannot really fix the price. I often run into data, X percentage of the firms in this industry control Y percent of the total market. And those statements are put forward without careful attention to what is the relevant market, what does control mean? If you want to play this statistical game, I would just point out that the data are very ambiguous at best. They tend, I think, to support the view that concentration has declined. But I don't want to get into that because I think the problem is that these markets are largely meaningless. We say so many, five firms sell 82% of the glass bottles produced in the United States without asking the question what that means. Who doesn't have adequate power because of that? I want to back up. Well, watch it. If I go too long, shut me up. But I want to, when I read Larry's notes, I realized I wanted to make a small speech on competition, as economists use the word. Competition, as economists use it, is a good thing. I know I say that because many of you don't think it is. But what we mean by competition is not besting someone else. But competition is striving to satisfy the criteria that others are using for allocating scarce goods. So producers and suppliers compete when they strive to satisfy the criteria that consumers or buyers are using in allocating their custom. That's competition. Now, economists like that. I like that. Because what competition does is increase the range of options available to people. Now, what does that have to do with power? For me, power, which is not a bad thing, power only becomes bad when it is power over against others. Power is bad when it diminishes the power of others. And that's not going to happen when others have their options continually expanded. When I argue that corporate power is less of a problem today than it was 80 years ago, I'm asserting that the people who come face to face with corporations, with the power of corporations, by and large are finding that their options are more numerous and better, consequently that they themselves have more freedom and power than they used to have. I think this is overwhelmingly true, that the exceptions are indeed exceptions. Why? You know, it was contrary to all the evidence. Firms have gotten bigger. Be careful. Macy's is very large, but it doesn't mean it has a lot of power. I'm continually amazed at how many people think Safeway is a powerful corporation. It's kind of funny because I'm old enough to have grown up in the age when people were talking about A&P had all the power and could do everything it wanted. A&P, you know, and it's interesting. People were still claiming A&P had all the power when Safeway had taken over the number one position and A&P was almost bankrupt. But some of the forces in our society that have been operating steadily to erode corporate power are improved transportation, including the automobile, improved communication, education, large corporations themselves, which overcome barriers to entry. Barriers to entry, like capital requirements, you couldn't get in there unless you were pretty big because you had to start big. Those barriers have been extensively overcome by large corporations which have the capital and which slide into other corporations' territory. What has been called the triumph of alchemy, where, you know, somebody invents a product that does something and somebody else invents something else that does the same thing. Xerox comes along and comes up with a truly remarkable photocopier, and they've got a patent, by golly, and they got you. And, you know, aside from that, what Xerox really did, even when it was the only producer of a photocopier, it expanded our options, made us freer. We were no longer dependent on A.B. Dick. But before we could complain that Xerox was an awful monopoly, all sorts of people were getting around that patent and in and out. And, there are all sorts of reasons for this. Now, go on. But the basic problem is, I think our expectations rise faster than reality. And that's one of the reasons that we're always discontented. Now, about the big business, big government alliance, I think government, I hate to sound like a broken record. I know economists are always supposed to be suspicious of government. They're all basically Republicans who were nursed by Milton Friedman. But I can't help it. I think that government is the principal source of most unacceptable and excessive business power. Now, Larry kind of agrees with this. He talks about the league between government and big business. I don't like that league, but I think it's not as serious a problem, or domestic problem, as the use of government by small businesses and their associations, their trade associations. The milk producers, the fuel oil dealers, the gas station owners, the textile firms, the petroleum producers until 1973. You know, the real political clout in this country of oil was the clout of the Independent Oil Producers Association. Now, those were rich Texas characters. No, they weren't all Texas, but there were over 1,000 of them. That's no, you know, when we think of the big oil, the refiners. Refiners didn't have any market power until 1973. OPEC, this gave them enormous increases in inventory, but small bankers. The small bankers, not the big bankers, are the ones who control Washington. And big business comes to acquire dangerous political power, usually as it grows old and weak and inefficient. Yeah. U.S. Steel, Chrysler. Let's see. I've just a couple more things. Larry talks about the values promoted by corporate economic power via advertising. I don't believe these values are so much promoted as affirmed. I don't believe that advertising is very powerful. there's a lot of statistical evidence that would support this, that advertising is not, what advertising can get people to do is change their mind a teeny little bit. What advertisers do is they find out what you're thinking and what you're valuing and what you're scared of, and they play on that. Now, that has a tendency to affirm, but I think the evil runs much deeper than that. I think TV is powerful. I do think we tend to get, and I do in my own mind, sometimes I'm thinking about the power of television. I think that is enormous power. Kuhn was right. The medium is the message, and the passivity and all this sort of thing. But then we tend to say television and mean advertising, and say advertising would mean television. Let's keep them separate. If advertising is as powerful as some make it out to be, that would be handy, because then we could solve a lot of problems. Unfortunately, I don't think advertising is that powerful. And then the second last thing I want to say is, it may take a moment. Let me suggest a different analysis. It's complementary to yours, but there's a guy named Albert Hirschman, who's now at Princeton Institute for Advanced Studies, and Hirschman, in an interesting little book called Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, came up with what I think is one of the most insightful analyses of how values and the economic system interact. Hirschman said, there are basically two ways in which people can make institutions serve their purposes. He called one exit, and he called the other voice. Exit is the standard market technique. How do you get the grocery store to do your bidding? The answer is, if you don't like what they're doing, you exit. You go somewhere else. Right? And how do you get your church to do your bidding? Well, maybe you exit. But it's interesting. We learned that from the economy. There's another way of getting institutions to do your bidding, and that is to stay and fight it out. What you could do is go to the management of the Safeway and say, I don't like the brand of ketchup you're carrying, or whatever. And you could try to get them to change their policies. But that's too much trouble. So what do? You exit. Now, that's a very effective device. It frees us from a lot of committee meetings. There are lots of providers of products, and you pick the one you like. But notice a subtle effect of it. It undermines loyalty. It makes us highly mobile. Mobility, affluence, the market society, superficial loyalties, the decline of community, all the evils that you and I are concerned about seem to me to be better analyzed in terms of this model. What we have learned to do is skip out when we don't like it. We've learned that from the market, and we've applied it in areas where it is absolutely disastrous to apply it, like marriage. The last thing I want to say is, I don't like concentrated power either, but I always ask when someone says we must distribute power more widely, I ask, how? By whom? We tend to turn to government, and we also tend to wind up not with power distributed more widely, but with more power concentrated in government. The oil crisis beautifully illustrates this. I think that the oil companies got a very bad press. I used to hate the oil companies because they were always lobbying in Washington, getting import quotas. I hated the Texas oil producers and their oil depletion allowances. I used to blast them. I stopped blasting them in 1974 because they were getting blasted by everybody else, and I think largely unfairly. I will say flatly that I think the entire oil industry, petroleum industry, was extremely competitive after 1974. Sure, people were making huge profits, but they couldn't control them. They were windfall profits, indeed. But, you know, what we had, we got all upset. The Seven Sisters, the oil companies, there are so many of the oil, so many refiners and producers and everything. The idea of market power there, I find simply absurd. Without the Texas Railroad Commission, they were powerless until OPEC came along. But you know what we did? We saw big business, too powerful, strike them down. We feel weak and impotent, and we created the Department of Energy. Now there is power, and probably ineradicable. Power to do great evil, all in the name of justice. very little power is redistributed through the Department of Energy to poor people or weak people. I've said more than enough.
We give Larry a couple minutes for response, and then I'd like to open it up for any of you who have questions to address either to Paul or to Larry or to both of them on your particular question.
I think I hear, Paul, that we are both suspicious of high concentrations of power. Where we disagree is that you do not think the corporations represent that, but government does, and my contention is that both of them do.
Well, that our options have increased through the kind of competition that has been present. Am I correct in saying that that's primarily as consumers that our options have increased?
I think also with workers, employees.
But I guess I would have to ask whether that's the case for production, for acquiring resources, for such things, and I think our options have increased enormously as consumers. I'm not so sure that it's increased in other elements in our other areas of our life. I would still contend that the corporations do, in fact, wield great power, often in league with government. I mean, I think, for example, I don't know how the situation is right now, the most recent contracts, but a little while ago, if you wanted to import, if Ghana wanted to do business with the United States and selling some of its cocoa beans, it could do that by selling the raw cocoa beans. If it wanted to sell processed chocolate to us, candy bars, etc., there was a high tariff placed on that in order to enter this country. Well, the profits are made in the processing more than in the basic raw materials. So the corporations stood to benefit, and did, by such tariffs.
And the employees.
Yeah. The Ghana had everything working against it in terms of setting up that kind of industry there, which would process the cocoa in the chocolate, because then we wouldn't do it. We reward them if they send us the raw materials, and we penalize them if they get in on that which, in fact, makes money and then benefits their employees. Well, I don't think that was just a U.S. government decision to impose that tariff. I think that's the kind of example of a sort of league between powerful lobbying groups, which are expressive of private corporate interests, and our job, too. I mean, I think you can multiply the examples many, many times over. Shoe, textile industry, facing competition from third world nations. But it represents a high concentration of corporate power, it seems to me.
Very nice. I think that nicely illustrates stuff. You keep talking about corporate power, and I think that if there weren't lots of employees, if it weren't for the AFL-CIO right now, free trade would be in good shape. It's really the interest of people in jobs, the ability of the corporate managers to make the job plea, in fact, that allows them to win in Congress. So we agree on the problem and what's happening. We disagree on who's causing it and what you would have to get rid of to stop it. And you think if you get rid of corporate power, you'd stop it. And I don't think you would.
Well, maybe we mean something different, you and I, about corporate power. I don't mean just the managers or the board members. I mean the way in which we've organized our economic life, workers and managers alike, in an economy where the large corporation is a major active agent. I mean, I'm not talking about a conspiracy of managers and board members. I'm talking about the way in which industrial society has taken shape.
Why do you keep talking about corporations? And I'm puzzled. I'm sorry, but see, if you're really thinking of the whole industrial society, you're thinking of unions and small business and...
Well, not everybody. Now, workers, farms would be an example to point out the difference. Small farms, family farms, are one way of doing agriculture. Large corporations which buy land and then hire farmers to do that is another. I'm saying the latter is what I'm talking about.
Okay, but look, Larry, doesn't this nicely illustrate the point, though, that when did farmers have more political power? In the days of agribusiness or in the 1940s and early 50s when there were still lots of farmers and relatively small farmers? It seems to me the answer is clear. Small farmers have more political influence than agribusiness.
No, I just don't know.
I'll be
tough empirical
questions.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, we'll take some questions.
I'd like to pick up on something you said, and see if there's another point in it. Paul, you talked about the power the consumers exerted over the direction of the economy by our power to skip out on responsibility. And my question has to do with the interplay between rights and responsibilities. From the time we're born, that's a kind of basic theory which we all are taught by our parents. We have to be responsible for that which we do. Responsibilities go with rights. And then you talked about how we tend more now to skip out, which is the one way of saying that the tension between rights and responsibilities are broken down. Larry talked about how those market devices which we thought would help us have sometimes turned back on us and destroyed values which we held dearly in the first place. And again, kind of breakdown between rights and responsibilities. My sense of question has to do with whether the corporate form itself has been a kind of disaster for us, because with the advent of the corporate form of doing business, we separated rights and responsibilities from one another as they've traditionally been held together. Which is to say, if a businessman wanted to go into business before and the market didn't like what he was doing or wouldn't support him in his efforts, he lost out, and it not only meant he lost out his business, but that loss in business directly came through to him personally. And if the business went bankrupt, he went bankrupt. But there was a definite tie between his risk and his reward. There was a rights-responsibility connection. Now, the corporate form has broken that connection, it seems to me. And what we now have are owners who are insulated from the repercussions of their act. We have widely dispersed owners and shareholders, which, and I don't know the percentages here, which may be widely spread among small owners and may be concentrated in insurance companies and banks. I'm not sure which way that is. But we have a separation between ownership, the right to make a profit, and the responsibility, which should have gone along with that, is now divorced. Because if a corporation goes bankrupt, it doesn't necessarily touch the individual assets of the person. That was what we thought was the brilliant part of the corporation form. And yet it seems to me in that separation, those of us who are corporate owners of very small shares now find we have no influence or have very little influence on corporate policy. And when we do attempt to make an impact on corporate policy, the buck is passed back and forth between managers who say their responsibility is to the boards who say, no, our responsibility is to the dispersed shareholders, and shareholders who say, well, but I've given my authority to the board. And the responsibility for the actions of the corporation just keeps being passed around and never focuses anywhere. And I wonder if that I've wondered if that isn't a contributing cause to the dissatisfaction we're feeling now.
I've got some things I would like to say in response to that, unfortunately. Three things. I think the problem of vague responsibility, of buffered responsibility, that you can't locate where the buck stops, is a serious problem in any large organization, and it's a serious problem in most major corporations. Some have been more successful than others in handling that problem. It's not good for them themselves, and good management recognizes this problem and tries to set the corporation up in a way that people who have, those who have control also feel the effects of bad decisions. Second observation would be that I think that the divorce between ownership and control, as it has always been called, has been exaggerated. It's true that no individual shareholder, and even large agglomerations of share ownership, cannot control the management of large corporations. But those corporations, the corporation managers are nonetheless controlled by the share market. If the corporation is not fairly well managed, what happens is the value of its stock tends to fall. It becomes a good deal on the stock market. It is quickly picked up by a raider, and the management is dumped. Consequently, management strives hard to maximize the present value of their shares, which reflects the estimated stream of future earnings into the rather long future. So I think we've got a pretty good system there. Now, it's true that when the corporation fails, the shareholders don't take much of the burden, but that's the way it ought to be. The people who really get it in the neck when the corporation fails is the managers, who lose their jobs. And unfortunately, they've developed the art of running to Washington and pleading the welfare of the workers so that they don't have to fail. But finally, the third point is, I think the serious problem is, it would join Joseph Schumpeter here, is that the corporation has made private property too impersonal. And consequently, people no longer feel a loyalty to the principle of private property. I've been doing a lot of reading in the period of the American Revolution, the American Constitution, the early 19th century, and it is astounding to discover the depth and breadth of the attachment of Americans to the principles of private property. And you wonder, what happened? And so that now today, if you stand up in a meeting and say, I object to that, that's a violation of the rights of private property, some people will nod and applaud, but others will hoot you out. I think what basically happened is that property has become too abstract. You don't feel an attachment to it. And that, I think, is one of the dangers of the corporation, and one of the ways in which, indeed, the modern corporation, a highly successful sociological invention, is indeed undermining the ground of values on which it rests.
I'm going to ask a quick follow-up, and that is, when the axe is about to fall, because the manager is the one who's on the dock, does that tend to make management of the major corporation focus on short-term gains rather than in the long-term value of, say, stewardship or conflict with three months?
I think it does not, because of the role of the stock market. I think it does not. The notion that managers focus on short-term gains is not true. They tend to take a longer-range view because it is in their interest to do so. Now, there are going to be exceptions, of course, but it's the share price that is the thing. And if management that is pursuing a very short-run policy is going to be perceived as doing that, and its share price is going to fall.
Aaron, did you have any comments?
Not on that one.
Another question.
Can I make a comment on the process? I really think that in most situations, management is really concerned on the short run. Because the thing that affects that pressure about more than anything is that annual report that comes out, and that bottom line, earnings per share. And from my experience, which is rather limited at this point in terms of a span of years, as an auditor of public companies, you would not believe the battles that go on as far as generally accepted accounting principles on where you're going to put the income and what year it's going to fall in. What management will do in trying to convince the auditor, no, we want to do this, because if it doesn't, that's just going to wipe out, you know, earnings per share by 22 cents a share, and that's going to destroy it.
Yeah.
And they'll do anything, even knowing, you know, that decision to make it, to get the income into the current year, really messes things up farther down the road. And I would say generally they're more interested now.
They're interested in, I've participated in those battles. I know how they try to dress up the corporate report, but it does not affect the price of the stock. The evidence on that, the statistical evidence on that, is just overwhelming. It doesn't affect the price of the stock.
Thank you.
in the long run or something.
The annual reports don't have zilch to do with price and stuff. You can doctor that corporate report until you're, for one thing, all the sophisticated investors already know everything that's in the corporate report. People who control the price of stock don't even read it. They cut out the pretty pictures and post them up on
the board. Who would control the price of stock? Can we follow on?
Well,
go ahead.
I think it's...
It seems contradictory to what you just said a minute ago, because you said, no, there aren't any large, significant, or a significant group of shareholders who control the board. And now you said there are people who control the price of the stock.
Well, just so anybody who wants to buy and sell shares of stock, you could decide that.
Yeah, well, I can't trade 200,000 shares.
But if you think your corporation is being badly managed and you sell, and a lot of other people have that opinion, and the price falls.
Yeah, but a lot of other people have to have that opinion.
Yeah,
I sell my shares of IBM, nothing.
I know, but of course, you don't want your opinion to run, to have a significant impact. It's got to be the opinion of a lot of sophisticated people who are willing to put their money where their mouth is. That should have an impact, and it does.
But how, there has to be a large dominant, not just...
Yeah.
Okay, I don't believe that the sophisticated investors out there have that information without the annual report.
I'd go on the stock buying in a second. Want to keep this point on corporate power.
If
we might be explicit in our... the way in which we think our understanding of Christian faith might inform our views, just to get that out. I mean, that's part of the forum.
I have a question for Paul. Early in your dissertation, you talked about first of all, your brother. I have two questions, actually. Your brother and corporate power, you alluded to the corporate power, and somehow your brother was forced to move.
Of course he can make that decision.
His job will be in jeopardy, but he's putting his job in front of his family, and he can make the decision.
That means that the company he's working for holds all the cards in the deck, except his accepting or rejecting.
Yes, but if enough people stop and say, okay, we're not going to move because of this, then eventually it will change. Now, if there's somebody else that decides, well, I'm going to put my family behind my job, my job comes first, then that will... Of course, if there are enough people that do that, then it will be for naught. He'll have a happy family, but he'll have to work for somebody else.